Spoilers?
Check.
Mature language?
Check.
Viewers beware?
Check. Record again.
Yeah, like I said, if I disappear, I'll be back. I'm going to go pick up the truck.
Understood. Understood. Well, I mean, do give us a warning of some kind. Don't just suddenly disappear.
Well, I will.
Just stay on your phone. What do you, just stay on your phone.
That's a point. That's an option.
Just stay on your phone. Talk while you're driving. It's a big deal.
I guess.
Okay.
So wait, are we doing all three movies or just the first one?
All three.
Okay, good. I just finished the third one like 30 minutes ago.
See, this motherfucker actually watched them. So he should, like, I did not watch any of these movies.
Yeah, but you'll have opinions. It'll be fine.
I was surprised how well the third one held up.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Save it till we're fuck.
Why don't you send us in, Mac?
Hey, everybody, welcome to Marvel Super Heroes Podcast. I'm Billy, which with me is
Diablo Frank
and
Senor Frixit.
Now, we're going to talk about the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy that spanned from, what, 2001 to whenever, when the third one come out?
I think it was 02 through 07.
02 through 07.
Because the whole reason why we're doing the trilogy is because it is the 20th anniversary. We've blown the deadline by quite a bit. It was released in May, but we're still celebrating the 20th anniversary of the entire three-movie franchise that Sam Raimi directed.
Gotcha. So, all right, let's
well, okay, quick question. So, I feel like Sam Raimi's major influence on the three movies was probably the first 5 or 6 years of Spider-Man comics, the majority of which were Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, but a good chunk were also John Romita. That period of time, have you guys ever experienced that? Because in a previous episode, we talked about the origin story and how we were exposed to that, but like beyond the origin, you know, Amazing Spider-Man number 1 through 70 or 80 or whatever. Did you guys ever read any of that shit?
Hold on.
Jesus Christ. No, I never read any. I've never read any super, super early like Silver Age Spider-Man stuff ever. Okay. I feel like I should have because of all of the, instances. It's like I feel like I've also read, you know, Golden Age Batman comic books, but it's only because I've just seen so much random Batman shit through the years. Because a lot of, you know, the animated series, you know, it's the same. It's all kind of the same stuff over and over and over again. So I feel like I've seen it, read it, but I have not.
God, I know. It's going to. I don't know how this is going to work.
Okay, so you're physically traveling at this point.
I'm physically traveling now. Okay. I'm recording my. Come on, let me take you. I got to go.
Are you driving? Hello? Huh? Are you driving or are you walking?
Come on. No, I'm about to take my mom to her house. Let's go. I'm going to take you home.
No, I'll come back later.
No, tell her I said hi.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
I was trying to answer some stuff out of my truck.
Hi, lady. I thought you were just dropping off the truck.
Hey, has your mom seen Spider-Man 2?
Call me when you're finished.
All right. Oh, this is going to be an interesting fucking day. Hold on. Now she's telling me, well, I'll be back. I'll be back. But she was going to empty out her truck right now, which I assume she had already done. Oh, this sucks. Okay, let's start all over. I'm good to go.
Well, are you still going to abandon this at some point in the near future, though?
No. Once we finish recording, I'm going to go pick it up.
Okay, we'll do our best. So how about you fix it? What of the early Spider-Man stuff, beyond the origin, up through, like, say, the first 5 years or so? Have you had any exposure to any of that?
Like comics?
Yeah. Like, did you read any of the Ditko stuff, any of the early Romita stuff?
I'm trying to think. No, I'd have to say I came in with McFarlane.
Yeah. And see, I was trying to think about this too, because I know a bunch. Oh, wait. Okay, good. Okay, just checking something. I know a bunch of elements of those early stories. I recognize the stuff when it turns out in the movies, and like I'm able to compare and contrast stuff that it occurred to me. I don't know how that was the case. I had to think about it for a little bit because the opportunities for me to be exposed to those early Spider-Man stories were mostly Marvel Tales. They were reprinting the Steve Ditko stuff, a lot of the early stuff in the mid 80s, and I know I thumbed through some of that material and I bought a few here and there. But the truth is, I was not really a Steve Ditko fan. It was a extension of like a lot of those Silver Age Marvel artists, the guys who built the house of Marvel. How in the 70s, these guys all went off and tried to do other things and pissed off the fanboys and they got alienated. And also they just were aging and they didn't have the skills that they used to have. They couldn't bring the game that they had. And so you guys probably remember, especially in the 80s and going into the 90s, Steve Ditko was pretty much a joke, right? I mean, this is the Squirrel Girl guy.
I didn't know that.
You know he created Squirrel Girl?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was in Marvel Superheroes, in fact.
Squirrel Girl. Huh? What issue is it? Well, okay, I can remember the first Spider-Man issue I bought. It's the one with Hobgoblin and it's a Hobgoblin lookalike where he touches things and things decay and he floats.
So this is much later though. We're talking about the 80s, yeah?
80s, okay, yeah. Because this was, I would say this is like in the 80s.
Yeah. So, but in general, have you had exposure to Steve Ditko? You know, his stuff, basics, and everything? Really?
No, I've heard his name just popped around.
Wow. And what about you, Mac? Do you have any opinions on Steve Ditko?
I know Steve. I mean, obviously, Steve Ditko designed the first red and gold Iron Man armor along with Doctor Strange and all the Spider-Man stuff, but he never stuck around on Iron Man, really. And then he didn't do he never got into the Avengers stuff, right? And that was kind of my circle. I did not do Spider-Man. I didn't do Doctor Strange. I mean, I always knew Steve Ditko was sort of like right under the Jack Kirby tier as far as importance to the comic book zeitgeist, right? But I can't, you know, I didn't read any Ditko stuff. You know what I'm saying? I've got some like Tales of Suspense that I'm pretty sure Ditko did back in the day, but really more than that, but I don't remember him becoming a joke, really?
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
To be honest with you, by the 90s, he was barely enough of a present to even be a joke, because aside from doing stuff like Squirrel Girl and an issue of Marvel Superheroes and like Speedball and a few odds and sods, he was pretty much out of comics going into the 90s.
Okay, no, here's
he did the Phantom 2040 comic adaptation. I remember that was totally random.
Wait, isn't he the same artist who did fucking Speedy doing heroin and shit?
No, that's Neil Kane, Adams, dude. Right?
Neil Adams.
My bad. Okay, never mind.
No. He was just another one of those like really washed Silver Age artists that was just like hanging on in the 90s. You know what I'm saying? There were those dudes, the Tuskas and stuff like that, who were like still trying. These dudes who were, where we had like Jim Lee, and then suddenly like one of these old like 60s era artists would just do a random issue, like a fill-in issue, and you're like, what the fuck is this? You know, I don't know if I think Steve Ditko was, I mean, maybe that's kind of what he was like.
He did some of that stuff, yeah. And you mentioned Tuska. Anybody who was reading Justice League in the 80s, looking at a George Perez cover, and then you crack it open and it's a fucking Tuska fill-in.
Right,
that's a fucking blow to the solar plexus of taste.
So when I'm reading in the early to mid-90s, that's, I don't know if it's like, this guy's a joke. It was just like, this is not, like you said, the cover artist. This is not the cover artist. this is some old washed-up dude trying to get paid for an issue, or an editor's kicking him a job for some spare change or whatever.
Yeah. And see, Ditko, as I got older and I was exposed to more of the quality stuff, I did develop an appreciation for him. But I had an aversion to those Marvel Tales stories. I liked some of the stuff he did on Doctor Strange and Strange Tales. Even then, I didn't have the originals of that. I had some reprints they did in the 70s. But it just never was a huge fan of the Ditko Spider-Man, which is heresy for some, because some people will just swear up and down that those first 3 years or so are the best Spider-Man comics ever. But they weren't really my jam. I'm really much more of a John Romita guy. I liked the look of the book and the tone of the book once he took over and it became a little less weird and creepy and high school based and that kind of shit.
So who did, and I remember this was always a big thing, right? Because didn't Steve Ditko do the art for Amazing Fantasy 15 on the interiors?
Yeah. The thing of it is, Kirby did the cover.
It's an alleged Kirby cover, right? Even though it totally does not look like a Jack Kirby cover.
It really doesn't, but I do believe it's a minimum a layout. Or maybe I don't think he inked it. He was an inker, so he must have at least laid it out. And I think maybe Ditko or somebody else went in there and Ditko'd it up.
I'm curious now. Hey, I gotta ask, Mr. Fixer, are you running a bath?
No, why?
I feel like I'm hearing like running water.
No, I'm just sitting here in my living room quietly.
No worries. Well,
as soon as he said no, why, it stopped. So anyway, I hope you enjoy your nice drawn bath. But so that's always been, that was the thing too. It was always like, Jack Kirby drew the cover of Amazing Fantasy 15. And it's like, it never looked like Jack Kirby. I just assumed it was actually Steve Ditko, or he'd laid it out or something like that. And then I knew that Steve Ditko had actually drawn Amazing Fantasy 15. So there was this whole, because you know, you're kind of brainwashed back in the day that Jack Kirby and Stan Lee literally created everything. And then you're like, Spider-Man's their biggest character. And it wasn't Jack Kirby. It was actually Steve Ditko. You're like, what? So that's why his name has always kind of been on a higher tier for me.
Well, Jack Kirby went to war against Marvel, he was claiming, he basically did a reverse on Stan Lee where he was claiming credit stuff that was a real overreach. And at one point he did try to lay claim to Spider-Man because he had done some early designs that in no way resembled the finished look. And a lot of it was like a borrowed from like his redo of The Fly from the Silver Age, where he had like a magic ring and shit. So Jack did pull a Stan Lee and overreached on his own influence on the creation of Spider-Man. So that might have been part of that as well.
Okay, so that is my Steve Ditko experience.
Yeah, and none of us are really going into the Spider-Man movie as huge Spider-Man fans. He's none of our favorites.
No.
That's
correct. And see, what I finally figured out how I knew a lot of that early Spider-Man stuff. Freaking Marvel Saga. My brother bought Marvel Saga, and I used to read that.
I remember those.
Yeah, and being that they were chronicling the early history of Marvel, you know, like the first issue or two definitely dealt a lot with like prehistory and World War II and that kind of shit, but they really rushed to get into the Silver Age stuff, the meat of the early Marvel universe. And so all those early Spider-Man stories, at least the first 15 or so issues, I remember being recounted in Marvel Saga, and that's how I have impressions on people like what's her fucking name? Betty Brant. You know, Betty Brant and Liz Allen and all these fucking people. It's like, how the fuck do I even know who these people are? Why do these people in any way matter to me? It's like, fucking Marvel Saga. So even the degree to which I was interested in early Spider-Man is still like a secondhand relation of those stories, not like I have a real affinity for the early stuff. But I believe that Sam Raimi grew up on that stuff and it influenced his take on Spider-Man.
Who am I? You sure you want to know? If somebody told you I was just your average ordinary guy, not a care in the world, somebody lied. Truth is, it wasn't always like this. There was a time when life was a lot less complicated. Can I take your picture for the school paper?
Sure. In this lab, we have 15 genetically enhanced super spiders.
There's 14. One's missing.
Peter, are you all right?
I'm fine.
Pete, look, you're changing. I know I went through exactly the same thing at your age.
No, not exactly.
Wow.
Peter, may I introduce my father, Norman Osborn?
Great honor to meet you, sir.
Harry tells me you're quite the science whiz. You know, I'm something of a scientist myself.
What the hell was that? Whatever it is, somebody has to stop it.
With great power comes great responsibility.
This is my gift.
Wow.
It is my curse.
Who are you?
Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
Do I get to say thank you this time?
Do too much. You're not Superman, you know.
Us not being huge fans of Spider-Man, like, how did we feel going into that first movie? I really want to focus on Fix-It too, because I have a little bit more insight on that. Where Fix-It, did you even see it theatrically?
Oh, no, I did. With Pussycat. I remember going to see it. What did you want to know? I mean, I was going to see it because it's a Spider-Man movie.
Under the compact where we, as people who were fans of comic books, tried to see almost every goddamn thing that got made into a movie, whether you liked the property or not. So I think that was probably a compulsion for a lot of us as well. It's like, well, we saw the Batman movies, we've got to go see the Spider-Man movie, for fuck's sake.
And this is pre-X-Men, right?
Nope.
X-Men came out first.
X-Men, because we did the 20th anniversary of the X-Men franchise in 2000, so 2020 for us. And I very much, when you're watching the credit sequence in the Spider-Man movies, there's a strong influence from X-Men. Like, you know how in the X-Men movies, they're always going through the DNA helixes and shit, and they do the same kind of shit with Spider-Man and the webbing?
That's true. Yeah, when they're showing the DNA, how they're taking DNA from other spiders and linking them to one DNA and creating a new breed.
Mm-hmm. So what were you just interested enough in Spider-Man to actually go to the theater, or was it more the fanboy compulsion? Or
fanboy compulsion? Yeah, no, dude, we had to see it. It was a comic book movie. I mean, this is stuff people talked about. I mean, up to that point, the only Spider-Man I remembered was the Spider-Man from the early Marvel movie.
You talking about the Nicholas Hammond television show? Yes. They would bundle it together into 26 used to run those on Saturday afternoons. I remember correctly, right?
Because they would do like two or three. They'd do like the Spider-Man movie. Mm-hmm. And then the Hulk versus Thor movie. Mm-hmm. and then the Incredible Hulk movie, the death of the Incredible Hulk. And so that, to me, that's what Marvel movies were. I mean, I don't think at the time I realized that Howard the Duck was a Marvel movie. And Blade had already come out, correct?
Yes, because we've done the truth is we missed the 20th anniversary of Blade 2. We're going to come back to it. We haven't forgotten it. We're just going to finish out the trilogy when we get a chance. I've watched a bunch of Blade shit, so you should probably watch some Blade shit if you want to converse on that. But yeah, actually, Blade came out in March of 2002, and I remember you, me, and Pussycat saw that one together, as I recall. But then a few months later, Spider-Man came out, and that was just you and Pussycat going to that one.
What, you talking about Blade?
Yeah, Blade 2 came out in 2002.
Oh, Blade 2. Okay, sorry. I thought you were saying
I'm about to say, if we miss one more, I think we lose nerd credit.
Right. Well, don't worry. We're going to get to the Blade stuff. But you guys, I don't think you guys have started watching those again, right?
Actually, for just the hell of it, I watched Blade 1 and 2 just to rewatch them. Not even a podcast. I just wanted to watch them.
Well, no, because I definitely want a podcast on it, because I watched that stuff before I got to the Spider-Man stuff. But I'm trying to hold that in my mind for us to talk about a later date once we're on the same page.
I actually, by accident, watched like an episode and a half of the Sticky Fingers one.
Yeah, I watched the majority of that show. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I watched a little bit of that. So that was...
Yeah. Okay. Save it for the podcast on that one, though. So getting back to Spider-Man, though, what did Pussycat think of the first Spider-Man movie?
She was more into anime. I don't think she, cared either way with it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things, the girlfriend just goes along for the ride.
Well, I mean, she was a fan, too, but maybe not so much of Spider-Man.
No. She didn't like... She was hardcore anime. She was not...
Yeah, that's bullshit. That's bullshit. I think everybody who went to go see Spider-Man the opening week... Spider-Man was huge. This is a huge fucking deal. Barbie acted like, this was sort of a nerd movie. This was not Blade. Spider-Man 1 was like a gigantic, massive... The build-up to Spider-Man was huge. Like, this was a gigantic blockbuster.
Yeah, it didn't make it to
everyday folks. Not normies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it was. Spider-Man? Are you kidding me? It was like fucking Jurassic Park. It was gigantic.
Normies walked in with maybe the knowledge of the cartoon or something along the lines of that.
Well, and I mean, you talked about it, though. It's like, you had the live-action TV show, and I think that was another instance where they canceled the show, not because it wasn't popular, but because CBS was getting tired of being like the proto-CW comic book network, and they thought it was tarnishing the Tiffany network, and so they canceled all the shit, Hulk, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, because they had too many, and they didn't want to be tarred and feathered, but it had decent ratings, and, us being hungry for superhero content, we watched those movies on Saturday afternoons, or we watched them in live action when they first came out, but the Spider-Man shit was nowhere near as good as the Hulk shit, the Hulk, I think, had a much more penetration as a live action figure. They'd already gone back and revived that for the TV movies and stuff, where Spider-Man really thrived in animation. And I think that if you weren't a comic fan, there were still a couple of generations of people who already knew Spider-Man from the 60s cartoon and then again from the early 80s cartoon.
I'd agree with that.
Hell, by the time the Spider-Man 3 came out, you had the 90s cartoon. That was a huge hit.
Yeah, we went through the whole 90s. Everybody in the 90s loved that Spider-Man cartoon. And this movie was a big fucking deal, dude. This says, according to Wikipedia, Spider-Man was the first film to pass $100 million in a single weekend, even when adjusting for inflation, with its $114.8 million opening. It's just like fucking gigantic movie. This wasn't some, we wandered into an art house flick, and she was just like, okay, I guess we'll see Spider-Man. Spider-Man.
No. She went because I went. If she had her choice, she would not have gone to Spider-Man. Okay. I absolutely know that.
If you say so, but this wasn't a movie that the normies weren't really in. Fucking kidding me, dude? It's the first movie ever to break $100 million in a weekend.
They took their kid. Teenagers went. No, and some adults too. I mean, it was the CG alone was something new. When you see Spider-Man fucking swinging through the sky, that was new. So yeah, I could see all that, but like not like us walking in there and already knowing the lore and shit like that.
Who fucking cares? I'm just telling you, this movie was an event. This was a huge fucking deal. It broke $100 million in 3 days in 2002. This was a gigantic, this wasn't like a, it didn't build, this wasn't like Blade where it was a comic book movie. I didn't even know Blade was a comic book movie. This is fucking huge. I remember the lead up to Spider-Man, dude, they were doing marketing for like a solid year before this movie came out. This movie was gigantic. gigantic.
Well, it's this like Blade was a successful sleeper, and it made something like $150-160 million. Where this movie made like 800 and some odd million dollars. It was the first superhero movie to gun for Titanic. It didn't make it there, but it actually was gunning for Titanic after Titanic broke all the records. And to a large degree, I mean, X-Men surely played a role. Those were very successful movies too. But Spider-Man was really like the first movie that came out after Batman 89, where it's like a cultural event, and like almost everybody went to go see that damn thing.
Dude, it says that the record for the highest 3-day gross, it didn't get beat until episode 3 Revenge of the Sith came out. Like, it took a Star Wars movie to knock this Spider-Man movie out in 3 days. Like, this movie was a gigantic hit. Like, insane.
Nobody's denying that.
Well, you're kind of underselling it, that it was sort of like, you're talking about normies.
No. People were going to see this movie, but you're trying to make it sound like, well, you know, people walked in there and already knowing about Spider-Man.
When did I say that?
That's
I didn't say
the vibe
that.
You're giving.
Well, oh no, you know, I'll take it back. Everybody fucking walked into this movie knowing about Spider-Man, because Spider-Man is like one of the top 3 or 4 most popular superheroes in the history of the fucking universe. So yeah, this is not the X-Men. The X-Men were a little more niche than fucking Spider-Man. It's Spider-Man. What are we doing here? This is a bizarre start to this podcast. It's fucking Spider-Man.
So now I know where Mac was when he went to see the movie, because we saw it together. I think we saw it at Cinemark, right?
It was Hollywood, right?
It might have been, yeah.
Yeah, it was Hollywood.
So you and I were sitting next to each other watching this movie. Neither one of us were Spider-Man fans. In fact, I think we had a running gag where we would tease my business partner at the comic shop, because she was a Spider-Man fan, and we would mess with her because I would be like probably the Cap guy and you would be the Iron Man guy, and we'd try to trash talk on Spider-Man, but she wouldn't join in because she wasn't an obnoxious boy like we were. So we were there because of the zeitgeist, not because we had any great passion for the movie.
Yeah, it was like also remember, this was the early 2000s. There was not a lot of shit to do other than go see movies. This was sort of like what people did. There were these big, you know, movies were events. You couldn't pick your seat out ahead of time. You'd have to go stand in line and wait in line for the ticket, and then you have to go stand in line and wait in line to be released into the movie theater to make sure you got a decent spot. I mean, this was like a whole, you had to like basically plan your whole day out on going to a movie like this. Yeah, it was a huge deal. Like, it didn't matter if you didn't like Spider-Man or not. It was still like a rare occurrence to have a comic book movie that they seemed to be taking serious. The X-Men movies had been okay, and Blade was good. So, and again, the promotion leading up to this movie was huge. So,
well,
it didn't guarantee it was going to be good. But
I mean, they had the teaser trailer that featured all new material, stuff that wasn't in the movie. And infamously, you had a bank heist with robbers who get away in a helicopter, and then they're snagged in a web, which is tied between the Twin Towers, which of course had to get changed or omitted because the Twin Towers were no longer there by the time Spider-Man came out.
Yeah, I remember that.
And honestly,
wasn't that in comic books too? Wasn't that one of the ads in the comics?
Yeah, I believe it was. So that's one of those deals where, like, after 9/11, all the stuff got scrubbed. Spider-Man got scrubbed as well. But I don't think they ever completely got the Twin Towers out of there, because I think that there's a lot of overt patriotism in the Spider-Man movie, particularly the ending where he jumps up on the American flag, and you have Chad Kroger, "We're heroes, save us." I really think a lot of it was Spider-Man. Don't get me wrong. And I know Spider-Man was a huge character and a very popular character, but I do think that there was a lot of people who saw that movie because it was the feel-good movie after 9/11 to some degree as well.
I hadn't thought of that, but I suppose that could be it. Nah, I'm going to go with no.
There's also a lot of pro-New York in that movie. Like, you know, we're all New Yorkers. We all stand together. I don't know if you remember, but there was the sequence where the Green Goblin has Mary Jane, and he's basically put Spider-Man in a trap, and all of a sudden the New Yorkers on the bridge start pelting Green Goblin, you know, saying, you know, leave him alone, he's one of ours, that kind of stuff. It was definitely present.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine, but I don't remember being like sad because of 9/11 and thinking I needed to go see a Spider-Man movie.
Remember too, they did that 9/11 comic book around that same time, J. Michael Krasinski and John Romita Jr.
John Romita Jr., right? Yeah, I've got
fucking
it.
Dr. Doom cried. Come on, guys. Dr. Doom didn't cry over 9/11, I assure you.
I don't even want to. I almost said something, and it's probably best that I didn't say
probably
it.
So, Mr. Fix-It, how did you feel after seeing the movie? Did you like the flick? What were your pros, cons? What did you feel about it?
Well, after rewatching it now, which I haven't seen in a very long time.
That's not what he asked you.
That's what I'm saying. When I watched it then compared to now, still the same. I still liked it. It held up.
You want to elaborate any further on that, though?
Well, I mean, it Willem Dafoe's fantastic as the Green Goblin. It's very San Raimi, which I never really realized until I watched a lot of Sam Raimi movies and then went back to it again, where the camera shot, the weird quick movements. I mean, back then I liked it a lot, and now I enjoyed it quite a bit when I watched it earlier today. I really still don't know why they picked Kristen Dunst to play Mary Jane. And when they picked her, I'm not sure what Mary Jane she was portraying, because she's really fucking annoying in the movie.
Before we get to that, I want to ask one question too. How do you think Spider-Man compared to the Batman movies and other Superman movies? Do you think that first movie coming out of the gate was strong enough to compete with those other ones?
I still think Batman, the Keaton Batman, practical effect, and it still fucking like pulled you into its world. This one, I mean, there's a lot of CG that just didn't hold up, and that's fine. It comes with time. But there's certain scene, like I remember there's a scene where he rescues her after the Green Goblin throws the bomb, and they're
the bridge?
No, not the bridge. They're watching the parade.
Oh, the parade.
The balcony. They're on the balcony.
Yeah, I got you.
He throws out the bottom of the balcony. They do the non-murder where he throws a bomb and it turns them into skeletons and then dust, so there wouldn't be any blood, even though the other bombs are exploding. I was like, okay, that's weird. But anyway, he catches Kristen Dunst and he's swinging away with her, and there's this one scene when he's gonna land with her and the webbing makes no sense. I'm watching it and it's like, where would that webbing be connected? It doesn't, like, nothing, the physics were weird. But that's just now, you know, like nitpicking now. But at the time, you know, I was just, it's kind of like when the first Superman movie came out and they're like, you'll believe a man can fly. I believed Spider-Man was swinging through the city. I mean, it looked fantastic at the time.
The two things that bugged me about Spider-Man 1 was Kirsten Dunst?
I thought it was Kirsten.
Yeah, Kirsten, I think.
Kirsten, okay, so it's the melding of the two. It's Kirsten. I think to this day, I still don't understand why they picked her. I guess, was she still riding off the fumes of Vampire Lestat or whatever?
She was a baby when she did that one.
Did she do anything else between?
No, she was a popular teen actress. She'd done the Bring It On movie, the first one. She'd done Get Over It, a lot of teen comedies and stuff. So she was definitely
those all
still,
missed me, bro.
Admittedly, they weren't your lane, but definitely she was a popular and successful child to teen actress, just like Tobey Maguire had done, like Cider House Rules and a bunch of like Ang Lee stuff. And he was sort of a little more art house, but definitely like Academy Award drama type stuff, not like full on, eating his own shit kind of like art house type of stuff. I'm talking about like awards bait kind of stuff. So they were both well-known actors in their age range.
But those were the things that still bother me when I look at this movie today, was that Tobey Maguire is fucking almost 30 years old and he's playing a high school kid.
Yeah.
Kirsten Dunst just seems out of place. And the William Dafoe Power Ranger suit.
Yeah, it's not Dafoe's fault. It's the fucking suit is awful.
The only thing is that the suit I've kind of come back around on, and that if they would have put him in like a rubber mask in 2002, it probably would have been worse. So it's so corny. I kind of like the outfit, but I remember leaving the movie, and even leading up to the movie, I couldn't get over those three things. Tobey Maguire ended up being okay in the movie. I ended up not having a problem with Tobey Maguire. Kirsten Dunst still bothered the shit out of me, and I remember absolutely hating the way Green Goblin looked. It was like, he already looks kind of lame in the comic books, and you found a way to make him look lamer. Those things bothered me, but I think, I remember on whole, I liked the movie just fine, and I was anticipating the second film. But those were things that bothered me, and when I look at it today, I'm like, yeah, okay, I get why that bothered me.
Well, and it kills me too, because a lot of that problem could have been solved by just using the Hobgoblin, who has less crazy colors. He has a cowl, so you don't even necessarily have to put a mask on him. If they just used the Hobgoblin instead of Green Goblin, I think that would have been up to their benefit for the technology at the time, the looks they were going for and everything. But yeah, I remember you and I both leaving that movie not super impressed. I mean, again, the effects, the look of Spider-Man, the look of the costume, the way he looked swinging through the city and shit, all that was fucking killer. That was exactly the shit that I missed watching Batman 89, is I wanted to see Batman swinging from building to building, with the cape flapping in the breeze and shit, and we never got to see that. It was always just up and down the elevator with this fucking grapple gun. So it was just so cool to see Spider-Man moving like Spider-Man was supposed to move and swinging through the ceiling and shit. It was when they were out of costume, that's when I think we both had problems with the flick.
Yeah, but like J.K. Simmons, fantastic. I mean, yeah. the casting in this whole movie is great.
Everybody but the leads.
I think William Dafoe is fine.
When he was doing that back and forth.
Yeah, totally. And look, dude, James Franco is his kid. James Franco, he didn't do much in the first movie, so it's not that big of a deal.
But it's weird because he's a handsome guy, but he still has a resemblance to Defoe, weirdly. You can totally believe that Defoe's character fucked like a really hot model, and that's how Franco ended up coming about.
Yeah, no, but like you said, you know, James Franco's not, I wouldn't put him on William Defoe's level as an actor, right? But he doesn't have a huge part in this movie, so it doesn't really matter. And then, like I said, J. Jonah Jameson's spot on. Kirsten Dunst with Miss Aunt May's fine. She's an old white lady. That's cool.
I still feel like she should be a walking prune, but and that's an issue. She was another issue I had too, because the Superman movie stole kind of liberally from Peter Parker and Spider-Man to more humanize Kansas and shit. And I remember when we were watching the movie, it's like, oh, they're trying to take it back, but Aunt May really looks more like Ma Kent more than she does Aunt May, and she's too nice and sweet and waspish and shit. And I felt there's a lot of derivation of this movie, like the all the fucking Spider-Man on the blow up parade floats. That's right out of Batman 89. How do you have two superhero movies with fucking parade like floats being a part of the action, you know? And then a lot of the scenes reminded me a lot of the Donner Superman movies, and it felt really safe and pussy. You're talking about how you saw elements of Raimi in the first movie, and I struggled to find Raimi in that. I was going into the movie, I was hoping I was going to get something more like Darkman, like the hyperkinetic action and shit. And to me, it felt like much more reserved. And in particular, the only sequence that reminded me a lot of Raimi was Willem Dafoe talking to himself in the mirror and going mad and stuff. That was very Ash. But a lot of the movie felt very like
safe
and autumnal. And like, you know, Raimi had I don't think Raimi going into the 90s, I think Raimi was tired of being the guy who was the whiz kid who never got a fucking budget. And he really went for more mainstream movies. He did A Simple Plan, which was him basically doing a Coen Brothers movie, having been close personal friends with the Coen Brothers. You had like The Gift, which was a little bit more supernatural, but it still was a murder mystery kind of shit. He had that fucking baseball movie For the Love of the Game, his take on The Natural. It felt like he was really selling out at that point. And while I think that he was still the right choice for Spider-Man, and I think he pulled off stuff that other people maybe wouldn't have been able to, it really felt like a watered down, heavily diluted version of Raimi in that flick. And that would turn me off a lot. But also how much it was like other superhero movies and how safe it was.
But I think it was okay that it was safe, because I think once we get to Spider-Man 2, I think he was able to step out a little bit more in Spider-Man 2. And he was safe in Spider-Man 1, but it wasn't cornball and bad. You could easily have thought you were being safe making Spider-Man 1 and it been shit. Spider-Man 1 is not shit. Spider-Man 1 it's still, in my opinion, it's still a pretty good movie.
Dude, he did kill people. I mean,
right. And I was going to mention that at the end of this. Like when he's in No Way Home, is it No Way Home, right? The multiverse one where they mixed them all together.
Yeah, correct.
And all of the dead villains come back, and it's like, holy shit, every one of these movies, he murders two or three. Like, the villains never, like, maybe they survived. No, he kills every single one of these dudes, and it's like, the body's there, we're all good to go. Anyway, I thought it was kind of funny. Yeah, they don't cop out on the murder in this movie.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, he gets impaled. They straight up impale this dude. You know what I'm saying? It's pretty outrageous, given the G-ness of the rest.
Well, and I'm just really glad that Willem Dafoe got one really great supervillain to chew up, you know, scenery-wise. It's like, I wouldn't want to see him being stuck playing like Volko in the Aquaman movies and that be his total contribution to comic book movies, because he was made to do comic book movies. And Goblin was probably about the most perfect role you could have found for the guy.
And you know what? And I will apologize to our listeners for one of many things, but I don't think we brought up William Dafoe in our Moon Knight podcast, did we? But that's another, that's a way, I don't know, that's like it's a parallel for me. That was the next time I saw that done that well was in Moon Knight. The dual personalities where the actor's changing his entire face. And you're like, that is a completely different person. You don't have to say a word. I know exactly which of the different personalities this guy is right now. So yeah, props to Willem Dafoe for that. I don't know how many other actors would have been able to pull that off. Unfortunately, though, like I said, he kind of just gets remembered for the Power Ranger costume.
Well, obviously he had a redemption arc where he was very well embraced when he came back for No Way Home. And I don't want to get into No Way Home, but yeah. People have definitely, and let's face it, he's become a meme in the years since too. So I think that there's an embrace of him that maybe wasn't as present in 2002.
Yeah, he's a bit of a meme himself. Anyway, what else do we want to talk about this movie?
Since you guys were addressing it earlier, and I think it's a good transition into Spider-Man 2, Kirsten Dunst was always a fucking issue for me, and all of us, I think. And I think
the
main problem is she did a movie in the early 2000s. I don't remember what the name was. I think it was Julia Roberts or something. It was like a girls' boarding school or some shit. And I remember they did like like an Entertainment Weekly spread on it where they showed them all in costume and their period costume shit. And there's a shot of her where she is fucking Gwen Stacy in the fucking flesh. And right. She's already blonde and she already has that Gwen Stacy blonde vibe. I can totally see her being the daughter of the cop who's like the authority figure. And Spider-Man's kind of like having to deal with this, you know, his rebellious side coming out as he's dealing with the authority figure and shit. She absolutely should have been Gwen Stacy. And especially, you know, I don't remember if Fix-It watched that, but me and Mac used to watch Unhappily Ever After on the CW or the WB.
Mm-hmm. No, I did.
Yeah, Nikki yep. Cox is fucking Mary Jane Watson. They even cast her in Wizard Magazine with Leonardo DiCaprio for the James Cameron movie that never got made. She was vivacious in that way that Mary Jane would be, and she was an actual redhead. She would have been perfect, and to have her there, and then you have Gwen Stacy, but she's not Gwen Stacy, she's Mary Jane, drove me fucking nuts during all those movies.
Right, and Nikki Cox is like a total model, right? Which is what Mary Jane Watson was, a model, right? If I'm not completely whiffing on my... I mean, like, do you know what I'm saying? Like, but it's because they just called Gwen Stacy's character Mary Jane. They just did it backwards. And to this day, I don't understand why they made the decision to do that. Why was Mary Jane in the first movie? I have no freaking clue. Is it because of the cartoon? I have no idea.
Yeah, and one of the things that does drive me nuts across the movies is in the very first movie, they do the iconic Green Goblin thing where you're threatening to kill off the female love interest. They don't. And then every other fucking movie has to do the exact same fucking thing with their character. And by the third, and you know, again, another ripoff of Batman, the constant screaming, like just like Vicki Vale. I got so tired of Kirsten Dunst hanging from a high place, waiting on Spider-Man to save her, and doing so all three fucking movies, multiple times in most of the movies. It got really fucking tired, especially by the third one. I was just over that shit.
I will say though, the most, probably one of the more iconic scenes of that entire first movie is the upside down kiss, which is pretty
cool. Oh yeah.
Which was awesome. I mean, that's a great, super awesome scene.
I think it's very noteworthy too, given how many people really have a strong affection for the Spider-Man movies. Those first two movies, she's a whiff of cloth away from being topless in those movies. She is constantly soaking wet in tight-fitting outfits with clearly visible nipples. Guys are spanking it to her for sure.
So the scene, I thought was, for that scene, yes, you do see nipplage a little bit because they're definitely pointy. I'm surprised that Spider-Man didn't do more damage to the guys who were just about to rape her in front of him. He just kind of yanks him and beats him up a little bit.
And that's so not a scene you would have in a movie today either. Like, they still could do that in the early 2000s. Watching that today, you're like, holy fucking shit. Did you just threaten gang rape and your fucking $9 billion family feature? What the fuck? What were we on back then?
Yeah.
It's a little 90s holdover, I think.
Well, and let's not forget, too, after nearly getting gang raped, she's like, oh, but now I was giddy to kiss Spider-Man. It's like, god damn, you shifted gears quick.
I believe there's a hero in all of us. Gives us strength, makes us noble. Even though sometimes we have to give up the thing we want the most.
Parker!
Where you been? Looking for you all morning.
You're late.
Always late.
You're fired.
Look at your paper. Your grades have been declining. You always appear exhausted.
I know, I'm trying.
So where you been, pal? You don't return my calls.
I've been kind of busy.
Taking pictures of your friend. Spider-Man killed my father.
No matter what I do.
Do you love me or not?
No matter how hard I try.
I want Spider-Man dead.
It's the ones I love who will always be the ones who pay.
I can't keep thinking about you. I'm getting married.
I want a life of my own. I'm Spider-Man. No more.
You look different.
I let things get in the way before. There was something I thought I had to do. I don't have to.
I like seeing you tonight, Peter.
Now on to the main event.
Octavius is going to put Oscorp on the map in a way my father never even dreamed of.
Crazy scientist turns himself into some kind of a monster. Four mechanical arms welded right onto his body.
You take Spider-Man's pictures. Where is he?
It's sick of me off your loyalty to Spider-Man and not your best friend. Bring Spider-Man to me.
How do I find him?
Peter Parker.
Find Spider-Man, or I'll peel the flesh off her bones.
There are bigger things happening here than me and you.
Thank you.
Now, on the second one, real quick, did y'all catch? I don't know why I caught it. I just thought it was funny. Whenever Dr. Octopus is, they're trying to name him, Jameson is trying to name him, and they're like Squid Doctor. And then Raimi's brother says Dr. Octopus. And then he says Dr. Strange. He goes, nope, that one's taken. And then he says Doc Ock instead, and they go with Doc Ock. I just thought that was really strange that he called his shot in Spider-Man 1.
Well, and we I remember that shit too. Just like when they referenced Superman and Batman and Robin, that was all what we needed to get hard on back then.
Yeah.
Just say the words Doctor and Strange together. You don't have to do shit. And we're still like, ooh, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange, they're in the same universe. We got so fucking excited over little shit like that back then.
I do remember how cool that was, but you're right, Mr. Fix. I had not thought about the irony that he then ended up doing Doctor Strange, 20 years later, which is insane.
Well, and I love that he got to do both of the Steve Ditko, Stan Lee icons. You know, that's cool.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And I mean, I thought Alfred Molina was fantastic as Dr. Octopus. Again, yes, Christian, whatever her name is. Dude, she's just, I felt like their love story was more of a filler, but it didn't seem like legit because she's fucking with Peter, but then she's kind of fucking with Osborne, and then she kind of goes back and forth. And
don't forget John Jameson. She was engaged to John Jameson in that movie.
Oh, yeah. And then, dude, it was just weird.
They did that guy wrong, too. There was nothing wrong with John Jameson. She totally fucking, you know, dangled that guy on a string. That was not cool because he did nothing to deserve that shit.
And then the funny thing was when he told her, he was the photographer at her engagement party. He's there taking pictures. He invites her to have lunch and basically tells her, forget him, get with me. We missed out on this. And she was about to do it. She's like, kiss me. I want to see, you know, if it's meant to be. And I'm like, dude, you just had an engagement party in front of all your friends and family, and now you're kissing your old flame. It was weird.
Well, hey, man, just like the
moment. Shoot or shoot.
Yeah. Just like when John Jameson is laying on the couch and she makes a point of kissing him upside down just to see if she can get the same spark with him.
That's
so creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but here's the thing. So where the charms of Kirsten Dunst were lost on me in the first movie, I saw the second movie as a rental, you know, when I was working at a video store, I got a free rental and I watched it then. And it just so happens that I've broken up with a girl who had a passing resemblance to Kirsten Dunst. And so I'm watching all this, you know, unrequited love, and it's like they feel for each other, but they don't feel for each other and all this kind of shit. And so I got a lot more sucked into that in that particular time frame. So I'm copping the bias. But I also think that the love story was much more effective in that second movie, which is funny because I had always had in my head that Kirsten Dunst and fucking Dope Face, what the fuck, Tobey Maguire, I had in my brain that they were together for the entire 3-picture deal, right? Which is one of the reasons why I've always found it extremely suspicious that in all the Spider-Man movies, the two leads always end up getting romantically attached, the two actors. But it turns out, I did a little research, they were only together for the first movie, and he had already hooked up with another girl for the second movie, which I'll come back to later on. And at some point in that time period, I think they ended up having a kid as well. So I'm wondering if some of that weird, unrequited energy might have had something to do with the fact that they had been together for the first movie, and they were busted up in the second movie, and there might have still been some like lingering feelings there, given that there was only a 2-year gap between the first and second flick. But I personally like that love story. I think it worked really well in the second movie, far better than the other two.
I think I'm with you. I remember her not being quite as grating in the second old Christy Dunst. I don't know if I remember her being as bad in the second movie as she was in the first movie. I also think they like less didn't wasn't her hair a little more like not so like crazy red. They backed off on the red. I think that was part of it too. It's like she's obviously got like a really bad dye job or a bad wig.
Yeah, I remember hating her. She looked more natural in the second movie than she did in either of the other two.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, it also probably helped too that she had a big glow up in the second movie because the whole point is that she's succeeding. She's not, you know, the you know, queen's trash, whatever the fuck you'd call it, where she's got the abusive father and all this kind of bullshit, all that baggage they put on her. So she's supposed to be a model. She's an actress. She's you know, taking the world's her oyster at that point in time. And so you're taking Kirsten Dunst, who let's say is an unconventional like beauty, like she's somebody who isn't everybody's taste, and they're giving her the best possible presentation, which I think helps her in the second movie. And then when they're trying to kind of minimize that in the first and third movie, I don't think that's to the actress's benefit.
So I'm with Mr. Fix-It. The excellent casting continues into the second movie with Albert Molina is just absolutely steals the show of this movie, even more than William Dafoe stole the first one. He's fantastic. Tobey Maguire just kind of continues to do his thing. He's perfectly fine, but I don't think he's the, well, I guess until you get to the third one. one. He's not really the focus of any of the films, right?
Well, you remember what happened between the first and second movies too, right?
What?
Okay.
9/11.
So Tobey Maguire.
Wait. He's did in Mr. Fixit just laugh at when I said 9/11? You can't laugh at 9/11, dude.
I'm still shocked you haven't brought in your Iron Man theory.
No. We're not. That's for Iron Man.
I was told I can't bring that up anymore.
Although I will point out that a teacher, Ben Kingsley, at one point was going to be the Vulture. He was the first choice for the Vulture.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, that would have been great. That would have been perfect. And then later on, it was going to be John Malkovich when they were still thinking they were going to do the fourth movie. So just to bring that into it. But anyway, so Tobey Maguire was in this huge movie, right? And so he's wanting to get his paycheck. You know, he'd already done quite well on the first movie. I think he made $4 million off the first movie. And I read somewhere that like Andrew Garfield only made $500,000 for his first Spider-Man movie. So Tobey Maguire was doing just fine, but he wanted more. And between the two movies, he did that fucking Seabiscuit, the one about the jockeys.
Yeah.
And so what he was doing is he was claiming that he had back problems after all that horseback riding and stuff.
Yeah.
And so he was stalling on coming back. He wanted more money. He didn't go and get the scans that he was supposed to get for the body scans to do to replicate him in CG and stuff. And so they actually fired his ass, and they were going to replace him with Jake Gyllenhaal. And like it was a done deal. He was literally fired. And so what ends up happening is that not only does he get his agents and do a full court press to get the job back, all of a sudden his back problems are totally healed up, but the girl he got together with between the first and second movies was the daughter of the head of Columbia Studios. So he kind of had an in to get the job back. And he eventually married and had a child with that woman, but they have since busted up. So just very interesting circumstances around that movie and Tobey Maguire's return to the flick. But apparently they didn't value him enough to where they were going to put up with all of his bullshit, and we almost got a Jake Gyllenhaal Spider-Man, which is why it was so funny for him to come back as Mysterio in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Dude, I totally forgot that he about the Seabiscuit shit where he broke his back. I totally forgot about that. But yeah, you're right. I did not remember that Jake Gyllenhaal got cast to replace him. I do not remember that.
Yeah, and I'm not 100% that they had signed him. I just know that he was the person they said was going to be the new Spider-Man, and then they went back on it once. Like,
dude, they look alike though, don't they?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, they played brothers in the movie Brothers with Jane Foster, Natalie Portman.
I never seen.
Okay. Well, I will say that's probably the best thing I've seen Tobey Maguire in, because he's playing a soldier with PTSD, who's suspicious of his brother and suspicious of his wife having an affair and all this kind of bullshit. And it felt like that's like the Tobey Maguire-est thing he could have done. I've always believed him more in that movie than I ever believed him as Peter Parker in Spider-Man, to be honest with you.
So I went to the Wikipedia page. Do you know who else was considered to be Dr. Octopus? Ed Harris, which I think would have been okay.
No.
Oh, it would have been okay. Chris Cooper.
I like Ed Harris, but that's a totally different interpretation. And I gotta say, Alfred Molina, I only knew him, I think he'd done Frida before then, and we all saw Frida because we wanted to see Salma Hayek naked, not because we had a huge interest in Frida Kahlo.
Shout out. Yeah.
But Alfred Molina is in that, and I think that's about the only thing I'd ever seen him in. But you're right, he is so perfect, so good, such a unique energy and perspective going into Dr. Octopus. You're so empathetic to him. Partly, I think, the actress they cast as his wife in that movie, for as little screen time as she's got, has such warmth, and they project such a lived-in relationship. And when she's cut down during that experiment, you feel that shit. So I have to give her credit as well. But Molina, it's very much like Mr. Freeze in the animated series, where they give him the tragic backstory, and you just need an actor who can really pull that off. And he absolutely sells it. He's probably one of the most sympathetic villains in any comic book movie. I really like the guy, and I love that he's not all ripped, and he didn't go for the fucking Chris Hemsworth workout shit. He still is the chubby guy like Dr. Octopus is supposed to be, but he still manages to work it and make it cool and have a physicality that's different from anybody else we've seen in any of these movies. He is fantastic. One of the best superhero movie villains ever. I loved him in this.
Yeah, he was fantastic. And it translated perfectly to No Way Home, because he stole that movie also. He and Willem Dafoe just absolutely killed that movie. But no, apparently Christopher Walken was in the running for Dr. Octopus 2, which would have been so bizarre. I wish it would have happened, but whatever.
He would have been a better goblin, I think. I could have definitely seen him as Green Goblin, not Dr. Octopus, though.
He should have been Flash Thompson.
No. Well, you know who Flash Thompson is, right?
He looked familiar.
I'm not going to swear by the pronunciation, but Joe Manganiello, the guy from Blood and all this kind of shit, he got all bulked up and stuff.
Oh, interesting. That's weird. Anyway, this was definitely it was way better than the first movie. The train scene is iconic, mm-hmm. right? Where he's stopping the train with all of his webs and then his mask comes off and they carry him. They're like, don't look at his face or whatever. Just absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. Best villain. I think Tobey Maguire is better in this movie than he was in the first movie. Like we already said, Kirsty Dunst is better in this movie than she was in the prior movie. This was really like the high point, in my opinion.
Is Fixit still with us or did we lose him? We lost him, didn't we?
I don't know who's in the call. I'm not in the actual.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm not actually. Yeah, he's not here. Okay. Well, shit. Okay.
Here, let me call him back. I can click the
button. Oh, no, here he is.
Oh, he's back.
Yeah. Hey, dude, I got to go do this thing, guys.
Okay. When do you think you'll be back?
Like 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. We'll vamp until then.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Well, let's do this then. I'm going to stop the recording.
Wish I was too dead to cry. A self-affliction fades. Stones to throw at my creator. Masochists to which I cater. You don't need to bother. I don't need to breathe. Keep slipping farther. But once I hold on, I won't let go till it bleeds.
Fix it. You were talking about your appreciation for Alfred Molina as Dr. Octopus, and I talked about how I think that he's very much like Mr. Freeze, where they did something with that character in that movie that made the character greater than he had been previously. And I think that you got stuff like Superior Spider-Man on the back of the work that specifically Alfred Molina and the screenwriters did in that specific movie.
I would say yes. I mean, he's a what do you call those relatable villain type character where you get why he's doing it. Now, that's what definitely had a lot of Raiminess to it, you gotta admit, especially more when the claws come up.
Yeah,
when the claws come to life, dude, they just murdered people. I was freaking out watching that scene.
The imagery in that scene is so good when he's laying face down on the operating table and the arms have like the medical cloth covering them all. Like, what a fucking great set. I mean the imagery it just so stands out in my head because you know what's about to happen. I'm a huge fan of that scene.
Yeah, me too.
And then yes, he brutally murders everybody in that room.
And no, the one part that freaked me out is there's a nurse that's being dragged across the ground and her nails are digging into the flooring, and you see the flooring coming up, and I was just like, dude, my hands hurt when I saw that thing. And I forgot how good the second one was.
Yeah, and I think that the second one, one thing I love is that because they got what's frustrating with the Marvel movies, the MCU movies, is a lot of times the origin is the best story, and then they kind of seem to struggle with what to do after they've told the origin story. Well, one of the things I really like about the Spider-Man trilogy is that having gotten the origin out of the way, the origin that we're all familiar with that are comic book fans, I'm sure there were a lot of cinema goers that weren't as familiar with it, but as fans we knew it, once they dispensed with that, they could actually get into telling a story in the second movie, and they really did that. That is a full on movie. It's got the proper structure, you've got highs and lows, and it's really well done, but also there's a prestige to the entire movie. It looks better than the first one, the effects are better, the acting is better, it has more Raiminess. I think Raimi has more confidence, more swagger in that movie than he had in the first one. You got fucking Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Michael Chabon working on the fucking screenplay. You've got Alex Ross painting images from the first movie to bring people up to speed in the second movie. Everything about this movie just feels like it's like elevated superherodom. You know, they love talking about elevated horror and stuff. This is elevated superheroics in that second movie, I feel like. It's just, it knows that it wants to be more than just another superhero movie, and it shows in the quality that we hits the screen.
Yeah, I remember this is definitely one of the instances where people talk about how, you know, the sequel's always worse, and this is always one of the ones where people talk about the sequel was definitely better, right? I mean, single way this movie was better.
I agree 100% on that.
And I'll also say the soundtrack to the first movie was pretty solid, very much a snapshot of its time. There's some other stuff in that soundtrack besides the hero. You've got Corey Taylor's song Bother, which I fucking love. I fucking feel the shit out of that song, especially in that time period. It's funny to me because you've got a Sum 41 song called What We're All About, and they are so trying their best to impersonate the Beastie Boys in that song. I would hope that you'd have heard and dismissed that song at some point, Mac, given how much you love the Beastie Boys.
I mean, they influenced quite a bit of that whole, like, nu metal rap rock stuff. So, I mean, it was sort of all of that stuff was cookie cutter. Yeah, all that stuff was Beastie Boys.
And then you also got the Hives, Hate to Say I Told You So, which was a big radio hit. And it's a pretty solid soundtrack. But the second movie, I think, has a much stronger soundtrack, and they incorporate it more into the movie, and they do it organically. I like that one quite a bit, too.
Oh, one more thing I forgot to say. In the subway scene, one of the bystanders in... Not subway, it's a above ground train, right? Or was it a subway? What the fuck am I talking about here?
No, it's a subway train.
Okay, anyway, one of the bystanders in the train was comedian Joey Diaz.
I just noticed that today, yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck? I was like,
actually, he's the first one that says, you'll have to go through me.
Yeah, I was like, is that fucking Joey Diaz? Like, fucking random? Is this shit? This movie's like 20 years old. Anyway,
it's all about New York.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Going into the second movie, for the closing credits song, you've got Vindicated by Dashboard Confessional. I'm not like a big fan of that whole scene, the emo scene, but I think that's a really killer track and probably one of the best songs they ever did, except for maybe Hands Down. One of my coworkers when I was at the sex shop had brought the soundtrack up and it got quite a few plays, and I remember really liking that song, and I think it's a very triumphant song to close out Spider-Man 2 with. I actually like it considerably more than Hero. I will say, though, we have a bit of a reputation for going after Nickelback. I don't think any of us feel passionately enough about the band to actually actively hate them. We just make fun of how formulaic they are.
Oh, no, I think Mac absolutely actively hates them.
No, I think that the zeitgeist hates them enough for me. I don't need to say shit anymore. If you say Nickelback, say you're a fan of Nickelback, I don't need to say anything. I just step back and watch your fucking life burn to the ground, because at this point, they're just a fucking joke. They will sell out every show they go to with a bunch of fucking lame boomers, but that's fine. That's fine. Nobody outside of Houston's going to... They're a perfect buzz band, you know what I'm saying? Where it's people know the singles, they don't know any other song in the fucking album, but they own every album, you know what I'm saying?
With Sunny 99 9.1 wants to show just a little bit of teeth, they'll throw a photograph on there. You know, that's like the hardest the easy listening station will rock will be fucking Nickelback.
Is that the one we talked about getting a blowjob?
No, I remember you liking that one, doing blow like and getting a blowjob. I don't remember the name of that song, but I remember you really liking that one in that time period just because of how transgressive it was.
Yes.
Oh, you know what broke my heart one time? Jerry Cantrell went on stage with Nickelback and was like playing Alice in Chains with them and shit, and it like made me physically hurt. Just absolutely made me want to cry, because I love Jerry Cantrell and I love Alice in Chains and I fucking hate Nickelback, and I'm like, why are you on stage with these fucking losers? And it's because really, like, Nickelback's bigger than, like, probably bigger than Alice in Chains ever was, which is makes me want to, like, literally vomit into my own face and choke on that vomit. But it's just like, this isn't Alice in Chains is like the fucking coolest band ever, and Nickelback is the least cool band ever, you know what I'm saying? it's fucking strange.
Yeah, Alice in Chains has huge street cred. Nickelback has absolutely no street cred whatsoever. So some other songs, the Jet song Hold On is used in the movie and also in the soundtrack, and I think that's a really good song too. I have issues with Jet. I really hated their breakout single, but that's a really good song.
Thank you.
You tried to fill some emptiness till all you had spilled over.
And also, weirdly, there was a song that was a huge international hit, didn't do anything in the States, by an act called Anna, called We Are. And I remember that playing over the sound system at the sex shop and listening to the lyrics, and it's this weird recrimination about, like, watching from the picket fence and the devil is within and washing your hands, you're never clean. And given how much I associated the first Spider-Man movie with 9/11, it was weird to hear that song, because, like, is this like a fucking anti-Iraq war song on the goddamn Spider-Man 2 soundtrack? And this was, of course, at the time when there was a lot of blowback, especially in Europe, especially in the UK, but I think she's a Swedish act, against the Iraq war and shit. It's like, this is a really weird fucking song to have in this soundtrack, but I kind of dig it. It's very awkward. It's not a great lyrically well-written song, but it's an interesting tune. Overall, I think it's a good soundtrack for its time, but I oversold the Batman soundtracks in our previous podcast of the DC special. Having re-listened to them, I still think there's good stuff on there, and I think that Batman Forever in particular is a stronger soundtrack, but it's also just a bunch of singles from a bunch of acts that don't go together thrown onto a disc, where this actually feels a little bit more of a piece. These guys are all kind of in the same lane, and they are in a Spider-Man lane. I really believe that Peter Parker would listen to all these fucking douchebags.
See the devil on the doorstep now, my oh my, telling everybody on just how to live their lives, sliding down the information highway, buying in just like a bunch of fools. Time is ticking and we can't go back, my oh my. What about the world today? What about the place that we call home? We've never been so many and we've never been so alone. Keep watching for your picket fence. You keep talking but it makes no sense. You say we're not responsible, but we are, we are. You wash your hands, you come unclean, but fail to recognize the enemies within. You say we're not responsible, but we are, we are, we are.
Hooba Stank's on there. I mean, this is a piece de resistance of 2004. what Hooba Stank really is what put. I was like, I remember where I was in 2004.
They did that.
I was
that considering. Song, the one.
I was considering getting blonde tips, probably, and was wearing pants that were too baggy. That was incredible.
You would have never had it pulled off, man.
No way. It was not really ever in consideration. I made fun of those people, but they were making a lot of money off those, you know, giving everybody the Slim Shady look or whatever.
So anything left on Spider-Man 2, or should we move on to the third act?
I just want to say that if you go to YouTube and you Google Iron Man 1994
9/11
attacks at Pentagon Illuminati symbols, you'll see that in the 1994 cartoon of the Iron Man cartoon, the Mandarin was planning on crashing planes into the Pentagon and the Twin Towers. This is incredible. This is 1994. This was 7 years before the 9/11 attack. And there is no doubt in my mind that Osama bin Laden and ISIS had watched the Iron Man / Fantastic Four cartoon hour that would have played on Saturday morning. Now we can talk about Spider-Man 3.
And so, now we're on a list.
Ask MJ to marry me.
A man has to put his wife before himself. Can you do that, Peter?
Yeah, I think I can.
We have some new information. This is your uncle's actual killer. We lost his trail 2 days ago.
This man killed my uncle, and he's still out there.
Everybody needs help sometimes, Peter. Even Spider-Man.
Revenge is like a poison. It can take us over. And before you know it, it can turn you into something ugly.
The suit. Where'd this come from?
The power. It feels good. You lose yourself to it.
Whoa.
Spidey, love the new outfit.
Remember Ben Parker?
What does it matter to you anyway?
Everything!
Do you want to push me away?
Why would I want to push you away? I love you.
You knew this was coming, Pete.
I didn't kill your father!
We have to forgive each other, or everything we ever were will mean nothing.
I need your help. I have to stop it.
This could be the end of Spider-Man.
Oh, just to get this part out of the way, I've not listened to the Spider-Man 3 soundtrack. I very much like Batman and Robin, knowing the movie by reputation, I did a really effective job of just completely avoiding this movie and everything related to it. But I have to say, of the soundtrack, very little source music appears in the movie itself. It's almost all score. And one of the only songs that they play is Chubby Checker's The Twist. I guarantee you, no 20-something with their iPod was listening to Chubby fucking Chep in 2007. It almost took me out of the fucking movie, that shit happening.
This movie, Sam Raimi was absolutely telling Sony, fuck you.
Absolutely. This movie, I totally agree. Like, they fucking got jazz songs in this shit and no Hoobastank. We're going to put some fucking jazz music and fucking show tunes in this motherfucker.
Hey, wait. You realize Jet is on this fucking soundtrack, right?
But not in the movie.
I'm just saying that it's hilarious. You're like, no Jet, and Jet actually appeared on 2 of the 3 fucking movie soundtracks. Hilariously. Anyway, I think he's right after The Twist.
Well, yeah. And see, I don't know what song played over the closing credits, because I couldn't stand to watch the movie a minute longer, because for some reason, none of the Spider-Man movies were available to stream. You had to, watch it on cable and shit. And specifically, Spider-Man 3, the showing was the night before Minions came out. And for the entire length of the movie, for like a good size portion of the screen was a goddamn minion just sitting there with this big purple fucking fart cloud around him, taking up a good chunk of the screen. Who the fuck thinks that's effective marketing? Who wants to fuck? I fucking can't stand minions now, if for no other reason than because they were fucking haunting my viewing. And of course, what they do now on all the cable shows is when they go to the credits, all of a sudden everything goes to fucking flash forward to such a degree you can't read fucking shit, and they're running fucking ads. So I have no idea what fucking song played at the end of the goddamn thing. So I just wanted to get that out there, because fuck sci-fi. That no wonder nobody fucking wants to watch cable anymore.
So, hey, I have to confess, I know we're doing a podcast on these films. I have never seen Spider-Man 3, and I did not see Spider-Man 3 for this podcast. And for that, I truly apologize. So I'm going to have to let you guys take this one away.
Well, that's okay. Mr. Fix-It, when we talked about doing the 3 Spider-Man movies, all you kept talking about over and over again was how much you fucking hated Spider-Man 3 and how much you couldn't wait to fucking tear into this movie. And now you just rewatched it. Earlier today, right?
Yep.
And what was your takeaway?
Yeah,
it's really not bad.
It's definitely a fuck you, Sony, because it doesn't feel anything like the other 2 Spider-Man movies. The special effects for Sandman are actually pretty cool. They still hold up.
I like the Venom effects. I think the Venom effects are really good, especially the fucking when the symbiote is crawling around. That's some creepy looking shit.
But I still don't know why Topher Grace had like sharp teeth when the symbiote came off.
He had vampire teeth.
Yeah. And now as I watched the movie, there was one moment in the film that Sam Raimi could have done an amazing job with this movie. He would have been in a completely different
direction. It would have blown the minds. It would have been the pinnacle of the three. The scene where Peter and Mary Jane get on his little scooter and they're driving off and the symbiote is running behind him and it jumps on the plate. And I thought, wouldn't it have been so cool if the symbiote had jumped on Mary Jane instead of Peter? And the movie would have been Peter dealing with Mary Jane, aggressive, slowly becoming more aggressive and being a female Venom and having to deal with her.
Fuck, that would have been, that is, I want to see that movie. Good call, man. Nice.
And then not only that, kills Green Goblin for fucking with Peter. And now he has to deal with the fact that she killed his best friend and she's in love with him. And then you got to deal with Sandman being an asshole in the background. Boom, right there, dude. After watching that scene, I'm like, why didn't he go in that direction? That's the movie I would have loved to see.
The part that amazes me is I thought you were going for her having the short skirt and going up her gooch. So no. you went in a whole different Christ. Direction. It was for the best.
Jesus, man. Have you not been late in a while?
Hey, I will say, though, I'm like browsing this article on Spider-Man 3, and it does say, so this backs up what you were saying, Diablo Frank, about Sam Raimi being a fan of the Ditko and some of the Romita stuff, is that he does not like Venom at all. The studio told him, you have to use Venom. He's like, I don't want to use Venom. So he had to basically shoehorn him into the movie.
Which is funny, because I was looking at the movie, because it's a really crowded flick, and I was trying to think of what you could take out. You cannot take Venom out of this, because so much of the plot, it relates to the symbiote and Peter's reaction to it and what it does to his life and stuff. You can't, once Venom was in there, you could not get it fucking off again. It's almost fucking metaphor for the symbiote itself, how inextricably linked it is to this, the plot.
Right, because that's why he's going through all the mood swings and he gets the emo haircut and shit, the My Chemical Romance. How is My Chemical Romance not on this fucking soundtrack? I don't understand.
True.
I'm not sure if they existed yet, to be honest with you. I think they broke a couple or 3 years later. They got the Yeah Yeah Yeahs on this thing. I'm super shocked by that, and Wolf Mother and shit. But yeah, carry on, Mr. Fix It, though.
No, I'm just saying, I think that scene, that idea would have made this movie just highlight the other two and made it a true tragedy. Like, what does he do to, you know, how does he stop the woman he loves? But instead, we're stuck with a movie that made no sense because he puts on the symbiote suit, but he takes it off like a regular suit and puts it in a chest, like a drawer, and it walks around. And I guess it's almost like a drug where he has to come back to it to put it on to get a fix. But then on Eddie Brock, it's like almost like a, I don't know, dude. I get that he didn't want to do the comic book, their version of the symbiote. It was just weird, dude. Like, I remember when
it's very much like Iron Man 2 was a coded demon in a bottle, a coded alcoholism narrative based on his being contaminated by the arc reactor. This is very much a coke narrative. Absolutely 100%. It's about Peter doing coke, but the coke is the symbiote and how it fucks up his life. So he puts on the symbiote so he can fight more crime, so he'd be a better Spider-Man, so he can put on the symbiote. So, you know, it's very much that vibe.
I can see that.
Hey, and I just want to say, Michael McCormick Iron Man was totally around during this era, just FYI. And they actually had a song called Thank You for the Venom. How was that song? It came out in 04. That should have been on this fucking soundtrack.
I'm just not the aficionado that you are, Mac.
Me neither. This was a Google search.
I gotta say, when we went into Batman and Robin, I really expected to find stuff in that movie to like. I really expected that the consensus was too harsh in that movie, and I was gonna find some little gems or some element of camp and see some redemption in that movie. And then I see it, and it was a fucking kick to the nuts. It was just such a hateful, awful, terrible. Nobody wanted to make that movie, clearly. And this movie had elements of that going into it, but I think Raimi loves cinema too much, and I think that because he let Avi Arad talk him into putting Venom in there, and he didn't get to do the movie that he wanted to do, and he had to make all these compromises and shit, his rebelliousness within that movie, there's more Raimi in this movie than possibly any of the other ones. There's definitely a major fuck you vibe to it, major fuck the audience vibe to some degree. It's very much like him just doing whatever the fuck he wants to do and not caring about how people feel about it. But that anarchic spirit, I actually kind of embraced the movie. I think it's a lot better than it's given credit for, and I had a lot of fun watching the movie. I really think it's way, way, way overhated. It's not great. It's got major plot problems, and certainly if you're a fan of these characters, I can totally see it getting really super pissed off. But given that I don't give a fuck about Venom as a character, I don't give a fuck about the Sandman as a character, I don't give a fuck about Peter Parker as a character, and I think that's very much the same issue with Spider-Man 3 that you have with Iron Man 2 and the people who really hate that movie, is they don't like seeing their hero coming out looking bad and having a bad time and handling things poorly. They live vicariously through these heroes, and they react very viscerally against that negative representation of their characters. And this movie is all about making both Peter and Mary Jane look like shit. Harry looks like shit. Most of the people in this movie look like total assholes. And I think that's what they're reacting to. But it's not a bad flick. It's just got some plot problems. It's got some script problems. But it's way more enjoyable and way more interesting. And fucking, you can see the money on the screen, man. They spent a fuck ton on these special effects. They look really good. It's just got some problems I can see where people get bent out of shape. But I like this better than most of the other Spider-Man movies. So I like it better than the first one.
I think you liked it because it was a big fuck you movie.
That is definitely part of it. It's a very fuck you movie. And then what really caught me by surprise is there's a lot of shit that I thought was in Spider-Man 3 that was actually in Spider-Man 2. And so going into the movie, I was shocked at how little I knew about the movie. I know the fucking memes. I know him dancing and thrusting his crotch. I know, fucking Eric Redman with the fucking vampire fangs. I know the really obvious dumb shit. But like all the stuff with Captain Stacy and Gwen Stacy and a lot of the Sandman stuff, I knew about him being, Ben Parker's killer, because that's one of the things I had a problem with. Don't fuck with the essential lore. And it didn't really amount to a lot anyway. But like there was all this shit in the movie that I just like had no idea about. And I was surprised, pleasantly surprised with. And I didn't know necessarily where a lot of shit was going, especially with the second Green Goblin. I didn't know how that was going to play out. I halfway thought, it was like, holy shit, were they going to do this expanded universe? And then they kind of clawed that back again. But it was way better than I was expecting. I was fully entertained by the thing.
Can I just say one thing?
Uh-huh.
This shit fucking blows my mind here, okay? Because like I said, I didn't see the movie. But I did see that. Is Bryce Dallas Harper Gwen Stacy?
Yeah, right?
She's the most redheaded fucking person on the planet. They got a fucking redhead to play Gwen Stacy, and they got a blonde broad to play Mary Jane Watson. What the fuck? What were they thinking here?
Yeah.
Were they trying to like balance the universal scales?
Sam Raimi is the anti-Zack Snyder, where like nobody casts except for the villains are quite right, you know? Well, okay, and J. Jonah James.
Right. But I totally agree with you. So I watched like one of those like 5-minute recaps of the movies. The Venom effects, I was like, Venom and a Sandman effect, I thought both looked like way better than I thought they were going to. Way, way, way better. And I guess I never realized that Venom actually appeared in this movie. This is how little I knew of it. I didn't realize Eddie Brock was in this movie. I had no fuck clue. I thought that it was probably I guess my brain knew that the symbiote was like messing with Peter Parker, and that's why he was acting all emo and his hair was all like, what was the country singer dude? What the fuck is his name? I've had too much to drink tonight. Gaines.
Oh, God, Chris Gaines.
Chris Gaines. He went full Chris Gaines. Sorry, I fucked that up. So I thought that I didn't realize that Venom actually appeared in this movie. But when I did, I was like kind of surprised. He looked fairly faithful to the flick. But that was what I took away. I couldn't believe and like you said, Sandman 2. I thought Sandman looked good. Like the scene where he traps him in the sewer and the water is like melting him away and stuff. That looked surprisingly good.
And Thomas Hayden Church looks like he literally stepped off the fucking page of one of those Ditko drawings, or even one of the John Romita's. Like he is like one of the most faithful representations of a comic book character I've ever seen in a movie. It's startling. It's kind of weird, actually. It's like somebody from Dick Tracy wandered into the Spider-Man movie.
Yeah. I also think Bryce Dallas Howard's fucking hot. Sorry, redhead.
She's a pretty lady. Yeah. She didn't get a lot to do in the movie, though. She's pretty well raced. Just like fucking, what's her fucking name? Elizabeth Banks from Hunger Games and Zack and Miri Make a Porno and all these other movies. She's Betty Brant in all three of these movies. And she's really good looking and she's got cool hair and everything else. They do almost nothing with her in all three of the fucking movies, though, poor thing.
Right. Anyway, but I didn't see this movie. So how did this movie do at the box? Did it bomb?
No, it was actually the highest grossing Spider-Man movie of all time.
No shit.
It was finally outgrossed by, I think, the first of the MCU Spider-Man movies. But it held the record on Spider-Man movies for like a decade or more. It outperformed ones. Yeah, because each movie, again, it's one of those, like, you get the bump. Like, people love the first Spider-Man, and so that helped bump the second one up. People really love the second Spider-Man, and Venom's in the Spider-Man. There was a huge hype for this movie. That's part of the problem, is people went into this movie with high, high expectations for the representation of Venom, and they were really pissed off at how Venom was treated. But it made it was very front-loaded, but it made a fuck ton of money.
It's really weird to me, though, that, does Tobey Maguire have, like, no clout at all by the third movie? Like, what?
Absolutely not, because let's talk about this, too. It's like, I've already talked about him, in some of the weird, underhanded shit, and there's all this fucking shady shit that comes out about him. You know that he was part of Leo DiCaprio's pussy posse, and he actually, when DiCaprio started getting more serious with the people that are half his age, he actually tried to take over the pussy posse, like, fucking Tobey Maguire is the alpha male of the wolf pack and shit. I remember between the second and third Spider-Man movie, he once tried to move on Jessica Alba at a Coldplay concert when he was kind of chubby, and they fucking laughed in his face. Her and her girlfriends basically were making fun of him and laughing about him. he is such a fucking creepy dude. And I really wish that Jake Gyllenhaal would replace him in the second Spider-Man, because I think that that creepiness, that awkwardness work well in the first Spider-Man movie when he's supposed to be the nerd, supposed to be the guy who hasn't got his shit together. But as the movies progress and Spider-Man should be more capable and more confident and should be able to land a decent zinger and stuff, he is such a fucking dork with his dumb, stupid dork face, and he's kind of a creeper, and I can't stand the fucking guy. I mean, I can stand him over the course of a Spider-Man movie, but it's like, I can totally understand why he didn't have a huge career after making a fucking $1 billion for Sony, because I just don't, like, I have a gut level dislike of him, and everything I read about him makes me like him, dislike him even more. And so, no, I don't think he had any fucking clout coming out of these movies, because I don't think people like this dude.
Right? So, because, you know, like, if he was Robert Downey Jr., I feel, by the time he got to this third, I mean, I say that, and I fucking hate the third Iron Man movie, but, like, you want me to do what with my hair? You want to dance? Like, at what point would he be like, no, this is not, the first two movies we treated, like, rather seriously, and it seems like some of the stuff the third movie, they were doing the Batusi and shit, and they were going, like, way too kooky with it. Again, I haven't seen it, but just, I guess the memes have leaked into my brain.
Well, I mean, again, just like,
why is it so silly?
I had forgotten that whole dance sequence in the jazz club, where he's, like, scooting around on a chair and all this shit, and there's, like, literal, like, jazz music playing, he's playing the piano and all this other wacky shit. I did not realize that scene, I'd forgotten the scene happened, I had no idea it was that long, and it's like, wow, you had to know that the audience was not going to be with you on this. You had to know,
right?
You were just doing this for yourself. But again, I think especially after the whole, you know, oh, we're going to go and fire you from Spider-Man 2, I think that Tobey Maguire had no fucking pull, and I think that everybody knew that the movies were making Tobey Maguire was not making the movies, so
right.
I don't think he had any fucking heft in that. I don't think he had any kind of call on that. But what's funny to me is when he's walking around being a creeper and thrusting his fucking genitals at random women and shit, that feels more like Tobey Maguire to me than any of the fucking Peter Parker stuff.
Because of the reputation.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was more him. I think he might have even gotten off on getting to do that, because I think that's who he thinks he is in his mind. You know, that's why he could play it so well.
Hate him, dude.
Jesus, yeah, I didn't realize this was going to be fucking, we're going to put a hit out on fucking Tobey Maguire in this movie. Holy shit, or in this podcast. Yeah, I don't know, but that, I think maybe, you know, maybe between, so, but you know, he had done Seabiscuit, which did well, right? So,
Spider-Man and also Seabiscuit. The fact that Seabiscuit entered the conversation, the argument has already fallen. It's crumbled to dust.
He did, what is that other movie? Slaughterhouse Rules. What else?
Wasn't it Slaughterhouse Rules? Not Slaughterhouse.
Was it Slaughterhouse? I thought it was Slaughterhouse.
You wish it was Slaughterhouse. Almost all that shit he did before Spider-Man, though. Like, Spider-Man he peaked and then he collapsed after that. The only thing I think he did during the movies that anybody had any regard for was The Good German.
I mean,
I liked him in Pleasantville.
That was before Spider-Man.
Oh. Okay, I'm just saying, like, I don't know. I'm not going to shit all over Tobey Maguire. He sort of vanished off the face of the planet after Spider-Man 3, so he got his comeuppance, so I don't think we need to trash the guy. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems so weird that if this one grossed that much money, they didn't make a fourth one, but it seems, I'm guessing if Sam Raimi had as much issues, you know, with the Venom shoehorning and stuff, and he walked away from the project, it seems weird that it kind of just, I guess it didn't. How what was the gap between Spider-Man 3 and Amazing Spider-Man?
Well, with, you remember that was the big thing that was pissing people off, is there wasn't enough of a gap between the Spider-Man trilogy and then trying to reboot the trilogy.
Yeah. That's right.
So the plan was they wanted to have a new Spider-Man movie out by 2011, and Raimi kept working on these different versions of the screenplay with different people, and they were putting people, like, villains in and out of it, and they just couldn't get a script that anybody was happy with. And finally, because they had a set date for 2011, he was like, I can't make that date. I'm walking. And so he walked, and as a result of that, they gave up on the date, and they went looking for another director, and they finally actually released the reboot in 2012. So you go from 2007 for 3 to 2012 for the reboot.
I mean, 5 years kind of seems like an eternity now, but
yeah,
I guess at the time it was bizarre.
Too short, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially because, like, for years after the movie, even with the reception that he got, they were still talking about Raimi coming back and what villains he's going to use and all that kind of stuff. So it's not like he was out of people's minds for any period of time. Everybody was like, okay, where's the new movie? It just felt like too long since they came up with the fourth movie, but not like we're ready for a total reboot with a new cast, with a new director and a new direction. So that was, I think, an issue. So Fix It, what didn't work about the movie?
The third one?
Correct.
the fact that I went to it. It's a big fuck you film, dude.
Were there specific things, though, you can point to that they didn't, like, just rubbed you the wrong way and made you dislike the movie?
It didn't rub me the wrong way. It was disappointing to have the first two that were so good, and then this one just felt like he didn't give a shit.
I think he gave a shit. That's one of the things that I was surprised by with the movie, is I thought that it wasn't going to work on any level. I thought that people hated it so much that it was going to be a problem. I think that the narrative of Peter Parker's fall from grace, and he starts out, like, at his peak, and the relationship problems he runs into with Mary Jane, and her rightly having problems with how he's acting even before the symbiote makes the scene and stuff. I think that's interesting material, and I think it's because Raimi and his brother wrote the screenplay, like they do a lot of his movies. I don't think that they're as gifted with the nuances as Michael fucking Chabon is part of the problem, and I think that they had the problem in the first movie of setting up the one true pairing with the first movie, that you know he's supposed to end up with Mary Jane, and so by the third movie you're kind of stuck with that because they've run out of shit to do with her, and they have to contrive all these reasons to keep them apart, and they come up with some good reasons, but I think by the time you get to the third one you're tired of the back and forth with those two. I think that makes the movie more exhausting than it is compelling for audiences, because I think people liked that they were finally together at the end of the second movie, and then to have them get their relationship fucked up, and also a lot of the stuff they did to fuck up the relationship was dumb, like where she refuses his marriage proposal because she got choked out by James Franco and shit. That it was hard to believe, knowing that she knows all these people and she knows about the powers and stuff, it's hard to believe that she would go along with that for the long term and not be with Peter, and just there's a lot of stuff like that's really contrived. They do the whole thing where they try to give Sandman a heart with all the stuff with his daughter, but that's really kind of half-assed and they don't develop that enough. I think that Venom ends up kind of taking over the movie, and so a lot of other stuff gets pushed aside, and the Venom, Peter Parker and the symbiote works. Shoehorning in Topher Grace as the Dark Mirror Peter Parker, especially since Peter Parker is already the Dark Mirror Peter Parker in the fucking movie, it's too much. You don't need two Peters. You don't need two Mary Janes with Gwen Stacy and her relationship to Eddie Brock. And also, it's just so contrived. The Peter happens to take the suit off in the same church where Eddie Brock is praying for revenge against Peter Parker, and it just falls on him. And he also knows by seeing that Peter is Spider-Man, and so he's going after Peter personally. And also, Topher Grace is really terrible in this movie. Like, he's okay as the prick earlier on, but by the time he's Venom, he's a really terrible Venom, and he's really goofy, and it just, he does, when you see Venom with the teeth, and he's got the Venom head, and he looks more like what Tom Hardy would do in the later movies, that looks good, but every time you see Topher's face and Topher's attitude, he just cannot play Venom, and it's such a one-note, I'm the bad guy kind of take for a guy who's an anti-hero, that it really, I think, poisoned the well for the Venom character, and I think that's where a lot of the issues come from with that.
Yeah, what a weird choice. I mean, isn't Topher Grace, he's Peter Parker? Like, he's
in real life?
The thin, nerdy brunette.
Well, that's funny. Because he's Eric Foreman, people think that he's actually like a fucking, he's more like the Lars from Metallica, where he was like a tennis star before he ever got into acting. And he's apparently kind of a bit of a cocky prick. And he's the reason, he left that 70s show before anybody because he was ready to move on to his film career and shit. So he's really not. He's a little bit more of a Maguire. Than he is a Peter.
Yeah, no, but his build. I'm talking about the build. Well, he's not. That was
the whole point that they were specifically. He's a photojournalist or photographer in the movie. They're literally paralleling Peter Parker and Eddie Brock. They're treating him as though they're the same character essentially, and he's the bad version of Peter.
Wasn't Eddie Brock always like? I don't know. I guess maybe it was the '90s. So I always pictured Eddie Brock as being like kind of jacked.
Yes.
Yeah, he was. In the comics, he was.
The whole point is he's way bigger physically than Spider-Man, but in this movie, he's not. He's Peter Spies because he's basically just evil Spider-Man, reverse Spider-Man.
And
I get it,
he's dark Peter Parker, but I'm just like, in the comics, he's not that. So like, I guess it goes back to your point that if Venom fans were going to watch Venom, they didn't get Venom. They got fucking that 70s show, which is kind of weird.
And then you shoe in fucking Green Goblin, and really, they didn't seem to know what to do with him either.
The whole thing, that first fight at the beginning of the movie, I know they did that because they wanted to have an action sequence early on, but then he bumps his head and gets amnesia for half the movie. that's some goofy ass fucking shit. And I could definitely see where the audience wasn't with them on that too. And you can tell it's just a way for them to sideline him before they come back to him and make him an important part of the third act. But it's like, you haven't earned that because you've sidelined him for half the fucking movie, more than two thirds of the fucking movie. And now all of a sudden he's a full on villain who's going to fight Spider-Man and tell him about how sweet Mary Jane's kisses are and all this fucked up shit. Yeah, they didn't earn that, you know?
Yeah.
And then they try to make Sandman sympathetic, but they don't give him any time. So he doesn't get to get built up the way Alfred Molina does. None of the villains get built up enough. And then also in the case of James Franco's Green Goblin is they go right back to where he was in the second movie in the third act. And then they try to give him the big heroic sacrifice at the end. And it's like, by that point, you just don't care anymore, you know? And I'm speaking as somebody who enjoyed the movie, but you know, it just doesn't really work. I could see where, again, if you're invested in that story, you'd be a little bit pissed off about the resolution of it.
So I guess we can kind of wrap this up. What, which of the three Spider-Man franchises is best?
I don't think we're ready for that yet. I think because we need to go ahead and look at the other two on their own before we start comparing the whole lot of them.
Why? What are we gonna wait for 20? We're gonna do the 20th anniversary of the Amazing Spider-Man movies?
No, we can do the 10th anniversary of the duology, because there's a lot to say about Spider-Man 2. There's a lot to say about Amazing Spider-Man 2.
No, there's nothing to say about that. No, I'm going to say this.
You mean Amazing Spider-Man 2 or what?
Yes, Amazing Spider-Man 2. Have you seen that one?
That's the one with, hold on.
Electro.
Okay, yeah. Okay, because the first one's the lizard, right?
Correct. Okay. And I personally have not seen the first one since theatrical, so I need to revisit that one to be prepared to discuss it anyway. And I'd like to be able to compare the three Spider-Man, all that kind of stuff. I'm not prepared to do that right now. I need to rewatch Amazing Spider-Man.
The fact you don't remember them means it's probably last.
No, I liked Amazing Spider-Man. I enjoyed that theatrically.
The first one, but there's only two of them.
Huh? Yeah, they did two.
I don't remember the first one. I'm trying to think of it. I need to go back
and rewatch it. I want to see if what I liked about it the first time is still there, or if I was just beguiled by Andrew Garfield or what. So I really don't want to get into that.
Okay, I'll record on that one.
Bullshit cop out on this podcast.
So
the Nickelback and end this.
Hero.
They say that a hero can save us. I'm not gonna stand here and wait. I'll hold on to the wings of the eagles. Watch as we all fly away. And they're watching us. They're watching us. Yes, we all fly.
Permanent Marvelite Maximus followers include Chris Wozniak, or Woz, possibly the actual Marvel artist after looking at that, Alora Gurka, Gina Marie Venezia, Henry R. Nader, Hijacked Affairs, Jeannie Mole, Joel Men Meetings, Kate McCauley, Lawrence St. John, Mark Nemo, Melita Neubig, Michael Cochran, Mr. Boyce Jr., Rona Hainenberger, Rose Yastrzemski, Roseanne Eldridge, Ryan Rinaldo, Winnie Dator, and Zedout Bilal. And some of those people even didn't seen many DMs about their OnlyFans pages. Keepers of the Favorites Flame include Doldodo5, Pamung Kaskev Finn, 64 page special, Billet Spy Vinyl, Doc Strange, El Coleccionista de Comics, Freddie Atkins, Gregory Litchfield, Hello Berlin, Jeff Rothman, Watch Miss Marvel on Disney Plus, Jenna Reagan, John Soto, Raven JDK, John from Married with Comics Podcast, Keith G. Baker, Kenny Crowley Jr., Limore, Lizanne Oswalt, MM Beats, Mario DC, MB, Mike Ariana Mike, Mike Send Aliens to Me, Mike Davenport, Moose the Hobo with High Kick Matson, My Comic Book Collection 70s to 90s, The Nerdstalgic Podcast, Nick Spence, Salacious Rum, Scott X, Shanna Banana, Siskoid, Sox Fan 2021, Superbound, Wayne Burrows, Weird Warriors Podcast, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Yoko Gauman, NFT. Retweet frantic ones include Lawrence St. John and Talk Nerdy to Me. Canoes wrote, guys, this was probably my favorite episode ever. Love the breakdown of Loki's actions on the Helicarrier and when he was talking to Black Widow. And finally, the Mary Marvel Marching Society, 21st Century Boys, Dr. Ange, Anthony Cut the Shit Tony, Between the Pages Blog, Billy Hines, CH, Canoes, Chris Leiden, Dear Watchers, a Comics Omniverse Podcast, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, Eugene R. Hendricks, Voice Actor Home Studio, H, The Hammer Strikes, Random Geeky Stuff, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, Hashtag Get Faxed, Hashtag Wear a Mask, Hashtag BLM, Iowa's Joe Is, Jason Snicked Venable, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, King Size Comics Giant Size Fun Podcast, Marvel Universe Online Project, Randy Caldwell, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrection
Productions, and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Sean McLaughlin, Thunderbolt Max, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Too Dangerous, and William P. Marvel Superheroes Podcast is in no way affiliated with or endorsed by Marvel Entertainment. All characters mentioned and audio clips employed are believed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended against their copyright holders. The views expressed in this podcast are assumed legitimate, truthful, and solely possessed by the speaker.
That's more Creed. That sounded more like a Creed.
No, that's Pearl Jam.
On a wee hand, and a hiss a hono hono hey.
Yeah, that's Pearl Jam, 100%. If I remember correctly, that running joke, if you're going to sing like Pearl Jam, it has to be all vowels.
Hey, I owe you.
That's more like Elvis.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, yeah.
Go to YouTube and Google 9/11 Iron Man 1994. You gotta do it.
Censor. I'm censoring you. You have no fucking free speech right.
He's going into his Alex Jones moment.
Now let me tell you, I'm a little bit pushing
road spine brain medication and road spine. What is it? Steroids? I don't know.
Dick pills.
I look it. Listen.
Dick pills.
The Mandarin has lizard hands. You understand?
And they're gay frogs.
Spider-Man was gay. He turned him gay, and that's why he had My Chemical Romance hair.
I do think it is funny that they turned J. Jonah Jameson into Alex Jones, ironically, for the last three movies. Anyway.
Two.
Well, it was weird, too, because I think in the second one, when Peter Parker quit, he puts on his costume, and he's on the desk doing like all these weird poses. And I didn't understand what was the point of that scene.
Where he does all the weird poses in the second
one. What the fuck are you talking about?
J.J. is on his desk in the Spider-Man costume, because when Spider-Man quit,
the trash guy,
he finds his costume. He sells it to the Bugle, and there's a scene where Robbie and
I think that's a deleted scene, dude.
They're looking through the window, and it's a 2 to 3 minute bit of him like doing all these crazy poses.
That's a deleted scene, man. I just watched those fucking movies, and it wasn't in there.
I watched the fucking movie today.
Okay,
I'm telling you, I watched it.
Do you watch some like ultimate cut from the DVD or something?
The 2.1.
Okay, and that I think
it says right here: J. Jonah Jameson wearing Spider-Man suit, deleted scene.
Okay,
2004.
It's in the 2.1. If I own the movie,
it does. It says deleted scene - Spider-Man 2.1.
Yeah,
that is weird. I'm watching just like the YouTube thumbnail going, and that's really fucking bizarre.
Because like, it's weird. Because like the first Spider-Man, it's just the movie. The second one, you have Spider-Man 2 and at 2.1, and the Spider-Man 3, you have Spider-Man, and then you have Spider-Man the Editor's Edition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually watched a video doing a compare contrast and like some of the deleted scenes. There's like a sequence where the Sandman visits his daughter in the playground by becoming a sandcastle and shit.
Yeah, that's in it too.
Yeah.
Okay. Delete the last like 5 minutes out and then pick back up where we're talking about these deleted scenes.
That's the stinger.
Oh, this is so weird. Why is he pretending to be Spider-Man in the suit?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, one of the comic books
I picked up,
Amazing Spider-Man. Yeah. There was an issue that John Romita Jr. drew. I don't remember who wrote it, where it was all the fantasies of the characters, like Felicia Hardy's fantasy about her relationship with Peter. And one of them is J. Jonah Jameson fantasizing about being Spider-Man himself. So I think that they've grounded some of his animosity and envy, and so that would I think reflect that him getting the suit and then deciding to dance around and everything else. That's another thing that's so great about that second movie too, is you've got that iconic imagery where he's throwing the costume in the trash can and shit. You got the whole arc where he's basically impotent, he can no longer function as Spider-Man anymore, and he has an opportunity to like become a normal person again and shit. It actually benefits him and stuff. They did really interesting smart things with 2. I wish they'd had another screenwriter come in to polish up 3. I think it could have been a much better movie with some stuff nipped and tucked and improved upon.
I'm telling you, if you made Mary Jane the Venom, that would have been.
No, awesome. I agree. That was fucking cool. I dug that. It reminds me of the very brief sequence where that happens in the actual Venom movie. But obviously, that goes in a whole different direction in your take on Spider-Man. You're the fix it. You fixed Spider-Man. Fix it.
Yeah, I'm telling you, right
there, dude. Yeah. Yeah. No, I actually dig that. I'd like to see that movie too. Because she really does not have much to do in that movie. The stuff they come up with her to do is so contrived and painful. I really wish she'd been Gwen Stacy, and I think they probably should have done like they did in Amazing Spider-Man, where you kill her off in the second one, because they really overplayed that character as portrayed by Kirsten Dunst, and I think she does a good job playing a character. It's just not the character that she's been cast as. It drives me nuts that we've had three series of Spider-Man movies and we've yet to see Mary Jane Watson on the fucking screen. Nobody has played her correctly, so kind of a drag.
Yep, I agree.
I'm hitting the kill switch now.